Hello, welcome to episode 42 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bald man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. And once again, I am that bald man. My name is Graham Lee. The topic of this show is what I still have yet to learn, and it's motivated by a post I read during the week called 20 Things I've Learned in My 20 Years as a Software Engineer, which was written by Justin Etheridge. And I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this episode. Now, as with like most of this podcast, us more experienced engineers often sort of pontificate and share our experience and those sort of, you know, abstract theories and philosophies of software engineering and the work that we do that we've developed over that time. You know, Justin has learned 20 very useful things in his 20 years, and I have absolutely no fault with this list at all. It's a great article, and I fully recommend that you read it. And indeed, this idea that like those of us who are more experienced are publicising and sharing what we do is really important, because mentorship is the most common career pathway still in software engineering. As I've said on previous episodes, we have a much greater pool of graduates entering the field now, but most of them have computer science degrees, not software engineering. They haven't been given a grounding in the body of knowledge of our profession because that body of knowledge is not universally agreed upon. And, you know, I do a lot of this sort of pontification as well. I've already talked about the episodes of the podcast. There's the blog post that I write at sickpers.info, i.e. the website for this podcast has a blog that, if you're not aware about, you can also read. I write De Programmatica Ipsum with my friend Adrian Kosmachevsky. I'm going to put links to some of the books I've written in the show notes, and if you're on the SICPAS website, then you'll see them down the right-hand side if you look at any individual article. And yes, you know, while like the average career is probably about 50 years long at the moment, you know, those of us who either leave school at around 18 or leave university in our early 20s are going to work until our mid-60s or into our 70s. So, you know, a sort of 45 to 55 year career is the length of the career. It's still the case that a 17 to 20, so the reason I use the number 17 is that I have 17 years of experience, having sort of graduated in 2004, it now being 2021. Like, we are the experienced people in software engineering, even though we're only mid-career. That is not because of some weird like carousel thing that there aren't people with 50 years of experience. There certainly are, and a lot of them are in sort of policy positions in organisations like the ACM or the BCS, or are in a sort of higher management in enterprise, and you know, are still sharing their experience as well. The fact is that even though it is now a nearly century-old occupation, computer programming, software engineering, has been growing at such a vast rate that those of us who are sort of mid-career are still vastly outnumbered by the people who are newer in their career than us, and we still have learned a lot of things and often had to learn them through the like hard graft of experience rather than through sort of training, or at least, you know, through hand-me-down mentorship from the people behind us. But we have to sort of pass this forward if this knowledge is going to make it into the next generation. Despite like computers being able to produce Wikipedia or the Internet Archive or Google, you know, the irony is that despite the use of computers to systematize the world's information, software engineering is still a mentorship-led sort of, you know, guild discipline or craft discipline. So, yeah, we've got a lot ahead of us mid-career engineers, but we also have a lot of experience beyond what the people sort of, you know, below us in the career, the junior or early career engineers have. So we do a lot of sharing. We do a lot of talking about our experiences and sharing those sorts of abstract ideas that we've created, our lessons about what has worked and what doesn't work or hasn't worked. But we still have a long way to go. You know, where there's still, in my case, probably about 30 years ahead of me in my career. And so I should, you know, I need to open up to the fact that I'm not done yet. And a lot of mid-career engineers should probably be more open about the things that we haven't learned as well as the things that we have learned. You know, what are the gaps? What are the things that we see other people doing that we either don't yet know how to do or have never really got a grasp on at all? And I'm not really sort of talking about this like platitudinous idea. Some people say, oh, you've got to stay hungry, you've got to stay humble, you've got to keep learning, you never stop learning. But they don't talk about what it is that they're learning or why they don't feel the need to stop. And I think that that is important as well, because partly like for our own purposes, right, to sort of systematize what's in our head and to understand the directions in which we want to go, and partly to show that there is a sort of change in focus over the years. That when I was a very junior developer, I was mostly interested in like what next technology can I learn, what next what's the next like programming language, what's the next framework, what's the next advance in my ability to construct software. And as we'll see through this episode, that's no longer true. Now, one of the books, I mentioned that I'd written a few books. One of them, which is still available in LeanPub, and I've claimed that it is complete there, which is kind of true in one sense, but not in many others. It's called Appropriate Behavior. And I originally wrote it as the things that a software engineer needs to do that aren't the programming. Actually, probably the things that a programmer needs to do that aren't programming. One of the pieces of phrasing that I need to be more careful about is that software engineer covers a much broader collection of roles than merely computer programming. So appropriate behavior is the things that a programmer needs to know that aren't just programming. But now, reflecting on that book, I see gaps in it now, and I see that most of it is still very technical, even if it isn't directly related to the nuts and bolts of computer programming. It is still related to more the technical side than the social side of our jobs. And so I'm kind of going into this transition where I see more of a need to understand the social side. So yeah, what are the things that I need to learn 17 years into this career, and why do I want to learn them? I suppose the obvious place to start is with the doctorate that I'm doing at the moment. I'm researching kind of research software engineers. So this is the role that I have in Oxford University. It is a person whose job is to construct software for researchers, for academia. And it's kind of like a nascent profession, if you will. You know, this occupation that isn't purely being an academic. It isn't like tenure track, trying to get a professorship in doing some research. And it isn't purely software engineering either. It isn't just bashing out the codes and delivering. It's a sort of hybrid between the two. And this has sort of sprouted out of the academic career trajectory over the last few years. And it's trying to define its own skill set, value proposition, and trajectory. It's kind of trying to become a profession in its own right. And so what I'm asking is, how do these people think about software engineering, and what kind of theories can I come up with based on their own perceptions of these jobs in order to identify how they are effective and thus how they can be more effective? So it's a bit of how do software engineers think about software engineering, but it's also a bit of how do other people think about software engineering and software engineers, because you've got the academics, you've got the sort of grant holders, you've got all the people who are paying for this work to happen or asking for this work to happen or defining what work is happening. These people have an input too, and they have like their own views, and they're going to be sometimes in complement and sometimes in conflict with what the software engineers want to do. And then also what I'm learning is a bit of how do social scientists think about anything at all. You know, I was sort of brought up, I had a very sort of scientific positivist view of the world. Positivism is the idea that there is a truth to the universe and that it can be uncovered through science, that if you ask the right questions, do the right experiments, you will uncover what the truth is, that a question has the right answer. That's not true often in the social sciences, where you know a concept is defined in situation by the people who are doing the definition, or is interpreted by the people who are doing the interpretation. There may, some social scientists take that sort of positivist scientific approach. Others take a sort of interpretivist approach where, yes, there is a truth, but none of us can objectively know it. We can only compare our interpretations of it. And some take a constructivist approach where they say that, you know, in social contexts, that what we believe to be true is the thing that arises in the nexus of all of our interactions and doesn't have its own sort of objective existence. And I haven't got any experience of thinking of the world in those ways, or of exploring the world when that is the way that you think of it. So that's part of what I'm doing with this doctorate as well. The utility of all of this, of doing this doctorate, of finding out how research software engineers think that software engineering is done, or particularly that their job is done, is partly sort of embedding myself further into this like academic career network and progression that I found myself in, and also like being able to sort of interpret how to like define that path, because as I said, we're sort of at the definition stage. So, you know, like the people around me are looking to me to understand and find out what it is that I should be doing and how I'm doing it, as much as I am looking to them for that understanding. It's also these sorts of skills, particularly like the social sciences thing, are going to be very useful in terms of like not just the delivery of software, but that this whole consultancy thing that goes around it, the whole idea of like managing people, managing stakeholders' expectations, being able to suggest interventions to teams to help them get their results faster or perform better or whatever it is that they want to do, which kind of, you know, has benefits for like acting as an external consultant. It has benefits for acting as a manager internally, and generally is one of the things that I think is much more important than a technology choice in my career now. It's not that I like, if I choose a different programming language, I will become a 20% better programmer. It's if I understand the problem that I'm trying to solve way better, I can become a 200% better programmer, perhaps. So it's greater knowledge of context and then application of that knowledge of the context to both the solution of the problem that I'm trying to solve, but also the definition and agreement on that problem itself. And preferably, of course, all in a very evidence-based way, so that I'm not just saying, as a lot of us software engineers do, well, I've kind of tried this before and I think it's going to work here, but I have tried this before and these are the like measured outcomes, and this is how this context is similar, and this is why I want to propose this intervention here as well. So that's my first sort of big topic, is like the stuff that I'm doing for my PhD. And obviously, like, I still have another sort of couple of years or so on that, and so that is going to be the near-term focus of the things that I try to learn. But there's a load of business-related stuff as well. I am drinking through this podcast, and I think the sound of that occasionally pops up on the microphone. It is a Sunday evening, as it often is when I'm recording, and so I have a vitamin drink in my hand, and I have a hot chocolate on my desk. This is just to keep my throat going while I'm speaking. The next big topic is the things that are related to business, because you know, I have tried to run my own sort of independent businesses as either a micro ISV or an information security consultant or a like general sort of consulting CTO before, and it usually goes all right. Actually, the ISV, micro ISV thing, I've had a couple of product ideas that I have tried to take forward during my career, and I've never launched either of them. And I've had like plenty more that just exist as files on Evernote or like half-started software projects. You know, I can write the software, but can I launch a business around it? No, not really. I can make a lifestyle business that keeps me going for, you know, a couple of years, that you know, takes me out of an employment context I don't want to be in anymore, that gives me more control over my hours or over like my my direction, how I'm applied, but never one that translates into what you would call a successful business, one that like has that sort of recurring revenue that's just going to you know, keep me going for even the medium term, let alone the long term. So what goes into that? What are the things that I don't know about running a business that would be helpful, whether or not I want to run my own business again, would help me to you know, to once again be the adult in the room when I'm having the discussions, like, you know, with the board in a business, with the sort of academic stakeholders in the academic context, that, you know, let me take a balanced and intelligent view on the high level decisions that are being taken that then translate into the need to write some software. I'm not particularly good at product design, identifying the difference between I have like a software itch I want to scratch and I want to like find some people who have the same problem as me and then, you know, develop the feature set that is going to be the, you know, the thing that solves the problem for them in at least some way that's worth paying for and then can be iterated on. I have like bits and pieces of knowledge of the more sort of technical end, like the user experience design, the interaction design, the information architecture, but just going from here's the thing I would like to do to here is a bunch of people who would benefit from that and the way in which this thing benefits them is something that I've like basically never been particularly capable of doing. So like that is a whole field, and one that I really need to learn a lot more about. Related to that is marketing, telling people that I have a thing that can solve their problem. You know, even from consultancy, a lot of my consultancy arrangements I got through like word of mouth and existing knowledge, which, you know, is obviously fine for sort of helping your own immediate network out, but doesn't sort of scale up to either the point where you're getting more work in than you can deal with, nor does it scale up to the point where you start sort of hiring other people and developing a system that can be, you know, sort of taught and propagated out, and then get to the point where you're doing like the strategic stuff and not just in a client's office every day. So, yeah, marketing, like related to the product design stuff, it's working out what the benefits to people are and communicating them effectively. Again, something that I've never been good at. And as we've seen, even getting to market now in academia, like getting to market is a bit different. What you're typically doing is allowed to fail in a much more sort of friendly way than businesses. You know, you are allowed to get to the end of your project and write a report saying this is what we thought we were going to do, and it turns out it doesn't work like that. It can be hard to get negative results published, but it is a reasonable outcome of research. It has to be. You can't go into research knowing what the outcome is going to be. But you still don't make any friends doing it that way. You know, if you're on a collaboration and you're responsible for like one work stream out of say, 3 or 4 on a like funding round, and you get to the end and you go, yeah, I didn't do that, and everybody else needs that input in order to progress their parts, like, you're not going to be the most popular person in the room. So there is a bit of that sort of, like, being able not only to prioritize the technical work, but also to, you know when it's done enough, and to know what else needs to be done that isn't the construction of the codes. Maybe we don't need to write any software at all. Maybe we just need to, like, go out and interview some potential users and find out what their needs are. Like, getting those all sequenced and going in the right direction, once again, something that I don't have a lot of experience with and don't feel capable of doing a particularly good job at. So these things, these sort of identifying the market, identifying the product for the market, communicating the benefits of that product to the market, and getting the product out to that market, all of this business-related stuff I've talked about. The utility of that, again, is not necessarily focused on whether I want to go and, like, get an MBA or become an executive or a CTO or whatever. It's about better contextual understanding of the software that I'm working on, better prioritization based on the needs of the, you know, stakeholders who are going to be consuming the software, using it in whatever way, and being able to, like, identify and direct my work and the work of my team towards more valuable outcomes by knowing which outcomes have the value. But now let's actually look at, like, some of the software engineering things, some of the things that are much more closely identifiable as part of the profession, part of the sort of greater computer programming, if you like, the computer programming and the various things around it that go into producing some software. One of the things that I have never been good at, I've always known that I'm not good at it, and so I've always found ways to avoid needing to do it to any good depth, is estimation. You know, there's obviously the no estimate school, which says that software engineers are not good at estimation, and so therefore you shouldn't ask for their estimates and you shouldn't give estimates. And that's often not so much about being bad at estimation as it is about the consequences of being bad at estimation. A lot of organizations, I was just looking back at the Scrum handbook from the Agile transformation that one of my former employers went through, and it talks about the commitments that are made in the sprint planning session. Now, if you're asking me to estimate how much work I can get done over 2 weeks, and then telling me that I have committed to doing that much work over 2 weeks, when I know that I'm bad at estimation, then obviously I'm going to be very wary of actually making any estimates at all. That is the reason that, like, the sort of no estimates movement exists to a large extent. It is actually possible to get quite good at estimation. It's just something that I have never done, because the other way that you can flip the sort of agile approach is by saying, well, whatever we have at the end of this iteration will be more than we had before. If you prioritize correctly, then it will be more valuable than we had before, so we don't need to worry about it. We just need to, like, constantly reflect and adapt based on what we have done. That can go horrifically wrong. I've seen that go horrifically wrong when the actually what is getting delivered is bits of features, not, like, complete sort of product increments. And so you never actually get to the next valuable part, because as you sort of progress along the partial feature, change of plan, part of a different feature, part of different feature, part of different feature, change of plan, part of different feature, you never get to the point where the product becomes more valuable. And yes, it is possible to get better at software engineering estimation. There is a process, I think it's Watts Humphreys at the Carnegie Mellon Software Engineering Institute, had the personal software process that includes getting better at estimation by estimating for yourself how long you think a task is going to take, and then not only comparing it against actuals, but also writing memos about what went wrong, about why your estimate didn't match, and then refining your next iteration of estimation based on what you now know about the kinds of things that go wrong when you make your initial estimates, and like iterating on that until you're getting more and more accurate. So this is something it is possible to improve at. Another area that is within the software engineering sort of ambit is information security. In an abstract sense, I know quite a lot about information security. I even wrote a book on it, Professional Cocoa Application Security, a very long time ago now. And I acted as an independent security consultant for a couple of years on a lot of Mac apps. This was kind of before and into the launch of the Mac App Store, and also some iPhone apps. And I worked for a large enterprise as the mobile app security person in their sort of R&D labs. I know about the security. What I don't do is a very effective job of connecting that to day-to-day software engineering, you know, like projects I'm sort of working on at the university. I every so often go, oh, hang on, I haven't actually thought about the security of this thing yet, and then have a little panic and go, we don't know anything, we've got the security wrong, let's have a look. And like, you know, either argue for sort of getting some external resource, which frankly I need because I'm not that sort of rigorous at thinking about it, or have a little sort of, you know, planning session myself and come up with a few like top risks. But even just like having that sort of, you know, InfoSec risk register ticking along in the back of the project, or having an idea of like the OWASP top 10 and how the code does or doesn't address that, or how the project does or doesn't address those top 10 risks. You know, having that, what Microsoft called the secure development lifecycle, where the security is part of the planning and execution and reflection and testing and deployment of the software end to end. Something that I've not yet systematized, and I think is just becoming more crucial as more things that used to be spreadsheets become software, and more things that used to be software become online services and so on. And the third one, from the sort of engineering perspective, I would say is like test plans. You know, sort of comprehensive. Here are all of the things we need to test about this software before we're confident that it works. I do follow TDD. I've written a book on that. I do write the automated tests. I do remember in my automated tests to cover unhappy as well as happy paths. But do I do it to a level of rigor where there aren't still frequently defects like discovered in, say, beta or in pre-release or even in release that on reflection, you know, with hindsight, are actually fairly obvious and could have been caught if I was systematically thinking about it? Yeah, that still happens. You know, I understand things like boundary value analysis, equivalence partitioning, you know, the theory behind how it is that an expert tester, and I've worked with a few expert testers through my career, I understand the theory of what they're doing to construct these test plans, but I don't understand the practice of it. Like, you know, it would take me a very long time to come up with a good list of test cases for a feature that I'm writing, and I probably still wouldn't implement all of them, and probably would still have the occasional defect slipping out into production, even 17 years into my career. So that's the kind of those three things: estimation, secure development lifecycle, and better test planning are the kind of software engineering things I think I need to improve as a software engineer. Weirdly, like nothing in that kind of list has come through as being particularly technology related, right? There's no new programming languages, there's no new tools, there's no new frameworks. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I think partly I have a feeling that I'm more confident in picking that sort of thing up because that is the sort of thing that I've been doing throughout my career. You know, if I go back over my career, I started as a sysadmin using multiple different Unix systems, writing software in Objective-C, Perl, Python, Bash, Tickle, enabled a couple of other languages. I had to use Algol at one point in that job, actually. And then I became a tester, very junior tester for a company doing like GNU-Step, Linux, Objective-C stuff. Then a Mac software engineer, then iPhone like developer, software engineer, trainer. Then sort of had to do some like Rails stuff on the back end, some JavaScript stuff for the browser. And recently I've been doing a lot of Python and JavaScript. There's been, you know, various other programming languages in there, Java, C Sharp, Basic probably, Pascal certainly. You know, I could list more if I thought about it. A-Rex has come up a bit in small talk. And so I'm confident that if there is another language or framework I need to learn, then I'm going to pick it up. But I'm also confident that if I ignore a language or framework for long enough, it might well go away or just not become relevant to my task. You know, I remember being at RailsConf a few years ago, and a lot of the people who had become Rails developers because they already enjoyed Ruby, which is a very like small subset of the community, a lot of people picked up Ruby because they wanted to learn Rails. But the people who picked up Rails because they already knew Ruby were all talking about the Elixir language on the like Erlang machine and some web framework that I forget the name of that's on top of Elixir. And yeah, they're saying like this is the future, this is what like will replace Rails. And you know, I mean, there are plenty of companies using it in production, and I know people who are doing that, and I expect that at least a couple of them are listening to this podcast. So hello Elixir programmers. But I don't feel the need to like pick it up now. It isn't holding me back in my ability to construct web applications not knowing this thing. At some point, you know, I will join a team that is using Elixir or wants to use Elixir, and I'll actually finally read that Programming Elixir book, the Dave Thomas book that's sat on my bookshelf right now. I can see it from here. And I think that this is something that I've learned over the you know, over the past sort of 17 years, and maybe within the last 10, is that there are a couple of issues with this like idea that you always need to be constantly learning the latest thing, that there's, you know, loads of technical churn and you need to stay up to date. One of these problems is that it actually is true, but only for people who are more sort of not junior but you know, less far into their careers, because you don't yet have the experience on your CV of delivering software, of providing value to an employer, of being able to do the job. The only like question that people can ask really in terms of your experience is, do you yet have any basic competency at the tools we use, or are we going to have to teach you that from scratch? And then the people who have the competency in the tools are going to outshine the people who don't in that particular interview. So yes, when you are a less experienced or earlier career software engineer, it is important to stay up with the trends, because that is how you manage to get through like round one of the interview. Once you've been doing it for like 10 years and maybe you've got a few different technologies under your belt and can demonstrate evidence of that, you're demonstrating evidence that the technology choice is no longer a setback, is no longer an issue. Or you might have demonstrated that you are an expert in one particular sort of branch of the technology stack, or one particular choice of language, choice of frameworks or other tools, whatever. But then you're likely to look for opportunities to use that and to use that specialist knowledge. So you're not going to jump into a different, completely different context. But until you've done that bifurcation, it is important to kind of do that staying up to date. Once you're at like mid-career level, you realise that a lot of these things are actually fads, and you can wait until, as I said before, the fad intersects with the day job and adapt then. You can wait until someone comes to you with a project and says, right, we need to do this in Elixir. Or someone comes up and says, we've got this great job managing this team. They all use Haskell. So you're going to have to be able to like show that you can walk the Haskell walk as well as talk the Haskell talk in order to manage this team effectively. That can happen. You can adapt to it. So let me give some examples from my career. I haven't used Docker or Kubernetes up until around 2018, and they'd been around, particularly Docker, way earlier than that. Now, I knew about like virtualization in various forms, Solaris, like cheroots, zones they were called, FreeBSD jails, actual virtual machines, things like VMware and Parallels, and like hypervisors, the Linux KVM or the Xen hypervisor. So understanding that like Docker is a bit like this and works in these particular ways, not that big a deal. And I didn't use it until it became part of my job to do so. Another example, like most of the programming languages that I am using day to day are ones that are in the sort of top 10, top 20 of the Tyobi programming language. I get to use, the Tyobi programming language popularity index, or your favorite or least disfavored popularity index. I use Python and TypeScript in my day job, and obviously JavaScript because TypeScript. I use C, C++, Objective-C all the time. Still use Java occasionally. Still use a lot of Bash. Bash is decades old. I use, the programming languages that I use most frequently are, weirdly enough, the most popular programming languages. And if you're in that space, if you're in the region where you can use the things that are the popular and long-lasting languages, and you aren't deliberately changing languages every 12 to 18 months, then you don't have to change languages every 12 to 18 months. Let's go back over that list. Bash, decades old. Java, decades, like at least 20 years would only be 2001, so like 25 years old at least. Objective-C, probably nearly as old as me, 35 years old maybe. C++, same. C, well older than me, language from the 70s. JavaScript, again, at least 21 years old, maybe 25 years old. Python, similar story. You can avoid that rat race. You can avoid changing technology every 12 or 18 months just by backing the horses that are already winning, basically. And again, that especially goes for people who are earlier in their career. Just pick one of the top 10 languages that you're interested in and learn that, and you definitely find there are more opportunities to get hired as a junior engineer in those contexts than if you pick some esoteric or upcoming language to try and become an inexperienced programmer in. Because those more esoteric languages, they have smaller communities, they have fewer resources available, and that means that much more is expected of a small team. Not only do they have to perform well in order to justify the otherwise poor decision of using an esoteric technology, but they also have to do a lot of work for themselves that would otherwise be shared amongst the bigger community. So there are going to be much higher expectations, and there will be fewer junior roles. Not only fewer teams that are hiring, but those teams will be hiring more experienced developers. The other thing about this, like, Red Queen effect, the running fast to stand still, is that as you gain experience, and, you know, as I've said, most experience is either gained first-hand or second-hand through mentorship, or at least, like, indirect kinds of mentorship, like listening to podcasts like this or going to conference talks or whatever, you start to see the patterns. You start to see the things that are the same and the things that are different. And, you know, obviously some of those patterns are real, some of those patterns are fictitious, so, like, you know, only exist in my head. But you at least learn to see and identify and make use of similarities between new and existing technologies and see more of those than you see differences. So, for example, when Apple came up with Swift, they described it as Objective-C without the C. When I saw Swift, I saw comparisons with Objective-C, I saw comparisons with C++, but a lot of people who had been put off of Objective-C because of the way it worked saw Swift as something that wasn't like that, because it worked in a different way. There are similarities, there are differences, and if you can identify the similarities, then you can translate all of your knowledge and experience into a new context very quickly. You don't have to, you won't necessarily be idiomatic, and you don't have to be idiomatic in the new language, but you are at least, you know, capable of delivery and capable of using it to solve the customer's problem, which ultimately is what we're here for. Idiom is merely a sort of an internal professional effect that we use for comparing merit across members of our profession, because we don't really know how to measure the capability of software engineer yet. And a third thing about this, like, Red Queen effect is actually the engineering bit of software engineering remains the same, even as the technologies change. Now, large parts of the technology remain the same. People using this Elixir framework are using the same HTTP as people who are using Laravel on PHP or Ruby on Rails or WebObject on Objective-C, for that matter. You know, the business of what a web app does is not any different in 2021 than it was in 1995, even though the tools with which we do it have changed. But getting better at the engineering part, at, you know, the things that I said that I still need to improve at, identifying the right software to build and convincing the people who need it that it is the right software for their purposes, those help you get better faster than doing the same standard of work in newer technologies. That there are incremental differences in the, like, efficiency of expression or expressiveness of programming languages. There are incremental differences in the, like, you know, the power of expressing with a different editor or a different IDE. There are transformational differences in being able to build better software and being able to pick which is the right software to build and which is the wrong software to avoid building. That is transformational. Hence the focus on the things I identified: testing, security, estimation, design, and product. The things that I talked about wanting to improve. Either those come from my knowledge that the engineering bit of software engineering is the thing that is the transformational benefit, or the transformational benefit comes from knowing that these are the things that need to improve. But either way, they are correlated. That, you know, doing better at testing is the thing, or even not doing better at testing, but doing better at working out what you need to test so that you do better at building correctly, that's the thing that's going to reduce vastly the amount of rework that you do. Similar with security. You know, you're going to have a lot less like reacting to problems and a lot less dealing with vulnerabilities and with attacks if what you do is work out how to build software so that that is mitigated or that risk is transferred. Design and product. You're going to do much better if you work out how to identify the thing that will sell than if you try to work out how to sell the thing that you have built. Now, another issue with like the idea of a sort of purely technical career and then a purely technical approach to career development is that that when you get particularly advanced in your technical career, you still need to be able to convince other people, even if they are technologists, of the things that you're trying to get them to do. You know, if you want to go from say an early career developer who is able to take tasks from a priority board and successfully implement those tasks to a lead engineer or a principal engineer who is able to define the whole way that an industry works or the whole way that a company works, you've got to convince everyone else in that industry or that company that that's the way that they need to work. That is marketing. That's design. That's testing, making sure that the thing that you're advocating for does actually work in context. You know, we're back at exactly the same things that we need to run a business as we need to run an engineering organization, because it's all social. As you get further up the stack, it becomes less about the technology and much more about the society. Now, that's not to say that I feel that I have no need to improve in technical capabilities, or at least it is not to say that I feel that there is no way in which I could improve. Let's separate those two things. There are like technical competency matrices, and even the ones that have been around for years haven't actually aged all that bad. Going back to my point that this Red Queen effect of running faster to stand still is a bit of a fiction within the software engineering world. So there's one called the Programmer Competency Matrix. I'm definitely not at level 3 on all of the elements in this matrix, and most of them are still relevant today. I would say that the only one that has not aged well is that at the time it was written, distributed version control was like the up-and-coming technology, and so it was level 3 on the version control, from like doesn't use version control through like, you know, checks in and checks out files to collaborates with others using a version control system, maintains branches correctly, and so on, to level 3, understands distributed version control, has used one of bizarre Git mercurial, etc. You know, everyone goes from not using version control now to using Git. Don't necessarily use it in a distributed sense. A lot of people just use like GitHub as a central repository, much as they used to use their organization's Subversion server. Nonetheless, you would automatically get level 3 for pretty much every engineer who has ever used version control within the last 5 years. So that one dimension hasn't aged well, but the rest of the matrix is pretty valid. On a bad day, if I can't remember all of the stuff that I've picked up about computer science throughout my career, I wouldn't be level 2 on the data structures or algorithms levels of this stack. I'd be level 1, which is above the like level 0 complete neophyte level, but is lower half of the matrix. Could I benefit from knowing more about that stuff? Certainly. Do I think it is the greatest benefit to my career to know more about that stuff? Well, maybe not. Don't forget, I work in a computer science department. I can always find someone else who understands algorithms, data structures, and could tell me which one I need to use in a particular context. But I can't necessarily find someone else who can design a product well. And you know, there's also on the level 3 side, a lot of places where you need to have built your own efficiency tools, like your own library of macros for your editor or IDE, your own set of helper functions for your programming language, or even like whole frameworks. And I haven't gone in for a lot of that through my career. So I definitely wouldn't hit level 3 on that. You know, I'm not saying that at 17 years into my career, I have maxed out my technical competency and my knowledge of software technology. And so now I'm broadening out from there, weeping because there are no more lands to conquer. What I'm saying is that moving forwards in the same direction and improving your technical competency may not be the best fit for my career. And that could well be more about interest than about ability to deliver. It certainly could be the case of maxing out on engineering, leveling up fully as a single role character, to use a Dungeons and Dragons reference, would yield great results. It's not where I want to go. I want to learn more about the engineering of software rather than the construction of software, the coding. So, you know, I'm not saying that I've hit the peak, and indeed the people who have hit the peak, or the people who say that they have hit the peak, are probably in the land of the expert beginner. Now, there's a good book, well, really a series of articles that has been gathered into a book, again, link in the show notes, about this idea of the expert beginner. And the analogy that the author uses is, imagine that you had taught yourself 10-pin bowling. You've got yourself down to the lanes, and you were throwing balls, and initially you're rubbish, you don't get a very good score at all, and your score improves, and you get to the 130s, 140s, and you sort of top out there. You could, and some people do this, not necessarily in bowling, but in professional contexts, such as programming, convince yourself that that is as far as it is possible to go, that you have hit the peak. 140 is an excellent score, particularly if you choose to surround yourself with people who haven't got 140s, particularly if you've been doing this self-taught approach for 5 years to get to the 140s, and you work only with people who are 2 years into a self-taught approach and are getting 80s, 90s, you can find a niche in which you will stay at the top of the local game, even though you're less than halfway along the path. What I'm not saying is that I have hit the top of technological capability. That would be expert beginner thinking. I'm saying that there are other areas where I think that my impact would be greater if I upskilled in those areas, and that is probably largely because they are more interesting. Something that I learned a while ago in my career, when I started doing management of software engineers for the first time, was that you don't look at what people are good at or bad at and decide to allocate tasks based on that access. You look at what they are interested in or uninterested in, and you allocate tasks on that access, because the people who are interested in it will get good at it because they will want to do more of it and they will want to do it better. The people who are uninterested in it, even if they are really good, are going to get demoralized, demotivated, disillusioned by having to do the things they don't like all the time, and then they will go away, and then you'll lose that the capability that they had at being good at the things they didn't like doing, but you'll also lose the potential for them to become good at other things as well. So I hope that I've achieved a couple of things here. One is that by talking about the areas in which I still need to grow, I've normalized the idea that this is a thing that software engineers talk about, that we don't only share our expertise, we share our gaps, and then people can understand how to interpret what we're saying, and they can understand what our particular contributions are, and they can help out. And so that's going to be part of my sort of sign-off request, is that if you do know things, if you know these concepts the estimation stuff, the security development lifecycle, software marketing, if you know those way much better than I do, and it won't take much for you to know them way better than I do, believe me, And you have shared your experiences in, like, you know, podcasts, blogs, books, conference talks, whatever. Please do link me those articles, those pieces of information. I would be very grateful, and I'm sure that the rest of this community would be very grateful to experience those things as well. You can drop them in comments on the blog website, on the post for this episode. You can email grahamlee@acm.org. You can send me a tweet, iwasleeg, I-W-A-S-L-E-E-G. Any way that you want to get these things out there, I'd be very grateful. Also, I want to mention, as I frequently do, the Patreon, which is at patreon.com/iamleeg, as you will have seen through this podcast. I do a lot of outreach. I do a lot of communication for software engineers, which I hope is useful to you in your careers, or, you know, if you're a hobbyist, is useful to you in, you know, in your pursuit of happiness. And and it would be great if you're able to support the production of these things, particularly, as I've mentioned, there's a bunch of gaps in the Appropriate Behavior book. I'd love to be able to take the time to go and fill that book in. And, you know, ultimately, I'd like it to be before the 100th anniversary of software engineering, which is actually in 2068. That's a long time off. But maybe before the 100th anniversary of software in about 2045. It would be great if that could be to software engineering what the art of computer programming is to computer science. And it is a long way from that goal. There is a lot of work ahead to achieve that. So thank you very much for listening. Do please get in touch. I will talk to you soon. Take care.